or vice chair right now, Olson Engineering.
Ali Safai, Public Works Development Engineering, covering Greg Schaefer today.
I'm Holly St. Pierre. I am Marty Snell's assistant for community development.
I'm Don Hardy for Jureta.
Eric Alino, SGA engineer. Steve Bacon for regional wastewater.
Mike Mandry, community planning.
Jamie Housley, Jordan Ramis.
Todd Gaither, Gaither and Sons Construction.
James Esterline, Lee Walker.
Ron Wearing, FM Line.
Julie Wilson, Park Council.
Jeff Mayer, for the services.
Steve Filthy with County Public Works Transportation.
Pete Bell,
Imperial Community Planning.
Brett Davis, Environmental Services.
All right, thank you all. If you haven't signed in, please do so before you leave today so that we have an active reading of who all attended today. Just a reminder that all of the D meetings are recorded and then posted on the county's website, so watch your language.
One comment about that. We found out that we haven't put in those on the website, the county website, and I'm not sure exactly. Do you know when we started or tried to do this?
Three or four months ago, yeah.
Yeah, that hasn't happened. We found out through somebody who was looking for the mining information, the discussion that happened last meeting or the meeting before. And then we checked into it. She wasn't able to find the audio on the website. And I checked. We are going to try to get it going. For some reason, it fell through the cracks. And that has not happened, just to let you know.
Okay.
So someone actually does check it?
Yeah.
Well, as a result of somebody saying that it wasn't there.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Next on the agenda is to review and adopt the minutes. And I'll entertain a motion.
Make a motion to adopt the minutes for December 5th.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions?
I'm going to abstain.
Okay. Let the record show that Mr. Housley and Mr. Gaither abstain. We'll review the upcoming events. Ollie, this is your part.
Yeah, BOCC hearing on traffic impact fees rate block in, extension, which is going to be on Tuesday, January 7 at 6 p.m. It's a night hearing. PC Planning Commission work sessions, there is one on January 16 discussing the comp plan, which include issue papers, commerce checklist, and public participation plan. And then the February 6 Planning Commission work session will be regarding the comp plan again and the county-wide planning policies. Also, I-502 marijuana facilities on Thursday, February 6th at 5:30 p.m. And Mike has come.
There's also a board work session scheduled just fairly late. It's on surface mining overlay.
Do you know the date of that?
January 15th, 9 a.m.
January 15th.
I think there's also one for the biannuals.
Is that a PC work session?
It's a hearing.
PC,
it's a hearing.
Board hearing?
Board hearing, yeah.
And Mike, was that a workshop or a hearing?
Workshop.
I had two hearings.
I have it, and I was hoping to verify it, but I have a January 14th date on my calendar for the biannuals at 10 o'clock. I'd like to have that confirmed, because I said that a while ago.
We will check it.
Is that January 14th? That
January 14th, Tuesday. The day I have.
Do we have a time?
10. That's what I have now as well.
Good, thank you. Correspondences, we don't have anything in our packet, but I know that we wanted to at least address the TIF rate lock extension. Not sure exactly who's... Mike, thank you.
Yeah, that's going to hearing calculation of traffic impact fees policy that we've had over the last few years. It's down to 2014, so it would apply to developments that receive preliminary approval from 2004 to 2005.
Jamie, did you have any comments on the memorandum that came out, or any comments on that before we proceed?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Any member announcements? None seen. Next thing on our agenda is to elect the DEEB officers. I'm currently acting as vice chair, so we'll need to vote on and elect a chair for this 2014 as well as a vice chair. So I will open up the, as a formality, I will open up the board or the table for nominations for chair.
I nominate Mr. Odrin for chair.
Second.
Okay. Second, any discussion?
Thank you for doing it.
You've been here and done that. all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? Thank you. Okay, as chair, I will open up the table for nominations for vice chair.
Probably Andrew or Don or one of the people who haven't served as chair before, or Steve. Who else is on the board that hasn't?
I think, well, has Ott, I don't know, is it Ott?
Yeah, Ott as well. He's come
to. He's got a full plate.
I wouldn't recommend Ott this year just due to his
he's president.
President of the
AAA.
Yeah, definitely. More engineer.
So I'll make a nomination.
We try to turn these and planners.
I'll make a nomination to nominate Andrew to be vice chair for 2014.
You're a second?
Second.
All right. Andrew, we've got a vote and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions?
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I would like to go back to the vacancies that are there. I, my understanding that Eric and Lott have both reapplied, but there may be, I know that there's Mike's position as well as potentially one other one that may be coming up. And I've had two people reach out to me over the past couple weeks expressing an interest. And I can't remember, we can make a recommendation to the board. Our desires for these people. One would be Jeff Riston. Jeff is the president of Kingston Homes, as well as a land developer. He served on the Planning Commission for 17 or so years. He's, I guess he's said he's sick of sitting on the sidelines, so he thought that the D might be the appropriate way to re-engage. He's got a new company. The second person would be Terry Wallen. Terry's also a developer / real estate agent, and I thought he might bring some legal to his perspective. But both of them independently expressed interest without any coaxing whatsoever, just said what would be the process of meeting them all. So I thought I would bring that to this group's attention. Just to
I think we need to know. So Mike's vacant position is for a contractor specifically,
correct.
And he was there only because he was. Chair of the contractors board. Are either of these people contractors?
I think Jeff could be considered.
Jeff could be considered a contractor. He's a builder. It's kind of, he could probably go either like odds position as a developer or a contractor.
And so it's Mike's position and which is the only one that's open, vacant right now, and then you and Ott are up for, have expressed your desire to stay on the board. Only thing I'd say is encourage them to fill out their letter of intent and send their resume to Jennifer at the board's office. And I don't know if we wanted to have any discussion about it. I don't know either of them. I know of Terry. I've spoken with Terry before about him personally, so I can't attest to anything.
My thought with him would if one of the other positions were to become available, and I have talked to one of our fellow board members that's not thinking of directly, that might be a more appropriate position for him. But Jeff certainly could fill the shoes of Mike. Considering also his extensive experience with the Planning Commission, I think he would be invaluable in those.
Okay.
Do we still have at-large positions?
Yes.
So one of those, if I remember correctly, they're flexible. It's kind of like whatever our agenda is. Like we could bring on a geotech if we were working on something for that year, or an architect, or those are a little more flexible with the contractor position. It's written in our bylaws. Mm-hmm. It needs to be a contractor.
Right. So we would need to see, and Ollie, maybe that's something you could find out fairly quickly, is to see what specific position Mike's was, whether it was an at-large or as a contractor or what. And then just, I guess, let the board know.
I think Mike's was a contractor because it was Jerry.
I believe
Mike's
so.
Was a contractor, yeah. Like mine's a municipal.
Right.
Who's at large?
Is Ott at large?
No, it's
he's a developer.
Don and Helen.
Don and Helen are at large?
Yeah. Okay.
I thought Mike was when he first came on board. Maybe not. Maybe he moved into a different one. I don't remember.
No, he took over from Jerry.
Oh, that's okay.
Well, I guess, once we find out from that was Ollie, then we can go ahead and make a decision. Well, you can kind of pass that along to them and, make that decision how they want.
Mike was the replacement for the attorney the first time around, and then he came in as a contractor representative later.
And that worked out. Okay, let's see. Andrew, congratulations. next item on our agenda is the concurrency and comp plan updates. Steve, you want to come up and... I know that you gave us a pretty comprehensive explanation of what was going on with the changes or the potential changes to concurrency, and we're just kind of looking for an update on that right now.
Do I get to go as quick as you want? Just a brief one-page status on progress today. We've had good progress, and we're number one there. What we're waiting for, the board was real busy last fall. We just couldn't get in to spend time with them. But we're attempting to set up a work session, a board time or something early in the new year when we can take our findings and results to them. So stay in touch for, again, it's probably a work session. We'll get it scheduled as quick as we can. Number two, one of the things that was slowing us down was a commitment by the county on the growth rate assumption that the comp plan is going to use. There was a work session prior to the holidays where the board did commit on that. I think it was the medium OFM 2035 projection, and they made that commitment. Things are proceeding, and we had actually been using that projection in all our modeling to date. So we are going to be consistent with their selected projection. Number three, and this is, I think, at the last time I briefed you, we're going to use a roadway segment volume to capacity ratio as our concurrency standard. Right now we're using a corridor travel speed standard, and that includes travel time through intersections on roadways both. But what we're going to now is just the volume to capacity ratio on the links or the segments themselves. We're getting away from measuring delay time of intersection. So it's a roadway segment, VC ratio, and tentatively we're looking at 90%. And when we run that through the models and then the analysis, we're showing a considerable reduction in the number of projects we need in 2035 at that 90% VC ratio that we have with the current program. We don't want to get into specific projects, but the list is dramatically reduced. Then under number four, in addition to those core projects, capacity and currency, there's other projects like bridge projects, safety projects, there are other possibly board preference projects, and then we're also going to have some allowances in the CFP for currently unforeseen concurrency and safety failures. So if we see one of those coming, we can move dollars, assign it from that, in essence, pot of money in the CFP, and assign it to that particular project. So we would like to fund all of the concurrency needs for the next 20 years out of that CFP pocket of money. So the bottom line under number five, it's really all good news at this point in time. We have a new draft level service methodology. We have modeled that methodology out to 2035 at that growth rate, and we've roughed out a CFP project list and 20-year cost estimate. And again, I would like to share it with you today, but until we actually get in front of the board and get their concurrence, staff is going to keep it under wraps. So just these four items at the bottom, I just wanted to put out there. I think they're important considerations as we move forward. First of all, concurrency on the roadway segments isn't the only thing that we're looking at when we approve development. One is the mobility standards and the intersections themselves. And in our current program, we have in addition to travel speed standards, we have what I call safety net standards. Like one intersection cannot have more than, I think it's 102 cycle lengths of maximum delay. So we need some safety net standards for individual intersections so that you don't get too much of a mobility problem. If that was to occur, then you have folks running yellows, they run reds, they short circuit through neighborhoods. So that's why we call them safety net standards. We also have our industry safety standards that we've adopted, like ASHTO and MUTCD. Those adopted by reference into code, so we have to pay attention to those. If those fail, they're safety standards the developer would have to mitigate. What we're hoping for in those pots of money I described that are in the CFP, we can move that money into those safety projects as we see the problem emerging. Number three, the board hasn't specifically talked about it, but from past discussions with them, with a downsized CFP, we can consider dropping TIF rates. We have a smaller rate base that we can put into the TIF rate structure. So conceivably, TIF rates could reduce. And the board hasn't specifically talked about that in the work session we had, but that's a very real possibility. And then number four, it's obvious if we have fewer projects on the CFP, then there's going to be less TIF credits available to developers when they're actually building frontage. Quite a lot of options now for developers. Depending where you build, they have TIF credits available, but with a downsized CFP, all those credits will not be available.
So why would that change? Why would it simply, because of this new measuring, traffic measuring tool, a model, why would that reduce the impact to the developer on his expense, for example, on frontage improvement?
This number four on the TIF credit?
Yeah.
What's going on there now? A developer gets TIF credits when they have to build frontage on a project the county has a future capital project.
It's been identified.
So it's been identified, it's on the CFP.
So in essence,
they would be double hit, they would have to build the frontage, and they have to pay a portion of their TIF for that same thing, be double charging it.
Yeah.
But if that project is not on the CFP, the county's not doing a project,
I understand.
Then they would have to make the physical improvements, build the asphalt improvements. But because the project's not on the CFP, it's not TIF credit.
I understand. Thank you. The TIF credits are measured in dollars, correct?
Absolute dollars.
Correct.
So if a developer builds $100,000 in frontage,
yeah,
they approximately get $100,000 in TIF credits.
Very good. Thank you. May I ask another question, please? How is the new capacity of a roadway going to be determined? How is capacity determined? I understand the lane times at an intersection,
level of service.
I understand that.
What it is that V is volume, C is capacity. So the capacity of a two-lane collector is, I'll just, 1,200 vehicles per hour each lane.
It's 800 to 900.
Okay, so where does that 1,200 come from?
That's a theoretical capacity. Traffic engineers study unimpeded roadway segments.
That's a national standard of some kind.
It's customized to some degree, to a slight degree, to Clark County. It's what RTC uses in all their models. I want to say it's 800, 900, 1,200.
For a two-lane road, it's 800 in each direction. It could be 900 if there's really very little development on either side. But for a three-lane road, it would be 1,200.
But where is this in a book somewhere? Is this the Bible or TC?
It's kind of the rule of thumb that's built into the ME2 modeling. So it's actually coded into each road segment.
But the
based on the highway capacity?
Highway capacity is, yeah.
I don't know that it is based on
It's not based on highway capacity, I think.
Yeah, I think there's a bunch of references that have looked at this. And the local entity that has adopted something for Clark County is RTC. It's in the regional model. And probably with Deeb's input, we'll pick what a theoretical volume is for a two-lane collector. Maybe it's 1,100 vehicles per hour. So that's 2,200 total. But we will work with the community to come up with an appropriate theoretical maximum capacity for each type of classification. And then assuming we use 0.9, take 0.9 of that, and if the actual volume gets above that, we're in concurrency code. 0.9 times that theoretical. That would be our standard.
So this VC ratio that we're going to go to is in use elsewhere in the state.
Okay. One of the RTC congestion monitoring reports, they talk about a 0.9 or 0.95. That, in essence, is a VC ratio.
Okay.
It's a percent of ultimate theoretical capacity.
Thank you, Steve.
Just a comment, not necessarily it's related but not directly to this, but the state funding came out where what Clark County expects to get from the gas tax, and I was shocked to see how little a percentage we're getting back to how much Clark County residents pay into that fund. We talked about it a little bit, Jamie and I, but it's a very small number percentage back that we're getting, so something like, you know what the percentage was? 3 to 5%.
3% roughly.
3% of what Clark County residents are paying in the gas tax is actually proposed to come back to Clark County. That's shocking. Is there anything that the county's done to kind of protest that or express their concern? How is that going to be able to fund our capital facility plan here in Clark County?
Well, I think our commissioners and other electeds in Clark County, they've made their interest known to Olympia. I know a letter's gone out. Concerned about it. This was prior to the holidays coming up. challenge is a lot of that money is earmarked for state highway projects, not necessarily the interstates, but 503, 502, 501. And it's hard to carve out some local road money out of that. I want to get money. But I think we've made our interest known for both the state projects in Clark County and the local road county, incorporated county projects in Clark County.
That's all trickle down. I mean, that money goes right into our fund. It's a much bigger deal, I think, than it's made out to be in the press. And it hasn't gotten a lot of press. Most people don't even realize it. That's what we're
the frustrating thing from our perspective is if we take care of our own local roads, and the bottleneck occurs at, later to 5.
We clearly, looking ahead at the CFP list we're doing, a lot of the projects we're seeing are not what you call regionally significant roadways, like 50th Avenue south of 179 and north of San Patrick Avenue. I don't know if it'll make the CFP cut, but historically we've had grade separated interchanges going at Andreessen and Patton and 503 and Patton. Those may not make this cut. But you could argue those are of such a size and magnitude that those should be partially state funded. Yeah. And what one of them is on a state facility.
Steve, will there be any changes to the traffic impact fee sub areas with this? Is there any vision for that for the safety net and maybe other kind of shuffling of funds that may be surplus to those areas that are most in need?
Staff's perspective is we would like to leave the districting the same. Every time we change district now, there's all sorts of challenges with existing TIF credits which districts are in, existing TIFs that have been quoted to developers. I know at least one of our commissioners would like to see a countywide unincorporated TIF rate, a single incorporated area TIF rate. City of Vancouver is embarking on an updated TIF plan. They could possibly redistrict. I really don't know. So I think there's uncertainty on where we'll go with the TIF program. But historically, the way we have done the TIF calculations, if the CFP goes down, the TIF rates go down roughly the same.
And then how soon after your meeting with the board will you be able to release that new CFP?
I think we can, it might be available at the work session if that's part of itself. I really don't know. I think there's lots of choices to be made about the projects to put on the list. And again, some are bridge projects, some are safety projects, some are mobility projects, some are beautification kinds of projects. But if you really want to keep the dollar amount down, you need to make, someone will have to make some hard choices about what's on there and what's not on there. But once we have the work session, once we get direction from the board, we can release the list very quickly.
Very good. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Moving on to an update on the final plat process. Chuck and Diana, what do you got for us? Can you do it in less than 30 seconds?
I do it less than 30 seconds. We submitted everything, all of our test documents and everything out to the applicant we're working with. Uh-huh. We have not got any feedback through yet, and we've got the first review and submitted them all back to them for the applicant, but we haven't received those items back yet. So we really haven't been able to test the flow of what we're trying to do.
Okay. Timelines, though, are staying on track so far?
Our goal is still to be on track.
Good.
Just waiting on it.
This test applicant that you're using, have they used the previous, are they experienced in this process?
Very experienced.
Yes, sir.
Great. Okay, good. When do you expect to hear anything more? Can we bring you back in February? Would you have more?
We'd love to, yeah.
Okay, why don't you put them down for February?
Okay.
I know we keep bringing you back, and you really don't have a lot, so we're just going to keep bringing you back until you have something to tell us.
Is that cool?
I think part of it, we haven't had as many complaints. I haven't heard as much from people saying their plans are taking forever.
Right.
So I think that right there is telling. So thanks for all your guys' effort.
I've got one that's going to be coming in here shortly, so we'll see how it plays out.
Well, that one will just blow us up.
And I appreciate that. Oh, by the way, we're not the surveyor on it, so it'll be a little interesting. Okay, looks like Ron's got maybe 45 minutes on the LID report, and I don't know how long Mr. Capel's going to be here, but I simply wanted to recognize him as his last day at work, I believe, right?
Tomorrow.
And thank him. Hopefully your new employer doesn't know that. I would like to thank you for all your time and service here at the county. I'm sure on behalf of the board that everything that you've come through with us and, you know, educated us as much as you can, and we appreciate you taking your time. And, you know, good luck in future endeavors.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Ron, you're up. Do you want to dim the lights? Or?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
People want to move around to where they can try and keep people away from visuals.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah.
So we wanted to take some time to talk to this advisory board about our a little bit about our new municipal stormwater permit. We've had conversations in here in the past about some of the requirements in that permit and how that translates into projects that we need to conduct over the next year to 18 months or so. So I'll do a little background. I don't think I've given this presentation to this group, but we have to other groups and our board as well. So there might be a little bit of background that I'll kind of skip, but part of our expectations, particularly to this board, as we get into our projects for updating our development codes and our stormwater design manual, we've set up two advisory committees, sort of ad hoc committees, a technical committee that's really helping us go over the technical details of what we have to do, and we purposefully asked members of this board to participate in those committees with Eric and Andrew on our TAC. I don't think there's anyone else on that. And then Jamie's sitting in our stakeholders group, which is just sort of higher level policy stuff. But we're getting input from that. We would hope, you know, you guys participate in the conversation today. I think we're here today just to provide an update, a status update of where we are on the project and answer any questions we can. Get additional input that way, but that's kind of what we're looking for. I don't think we have any requests for hard recommendations at this point.
Ron, I'm sorry, quick question. Who issues the MPDES Phase 1 municipal permit?
Yeah, good question. The Department of Ecology issues that permit to Clark County. They're the delegated authority by the federal government to implement the Clean Water Act in the state, and we also have a state water pollution control law that has a discharge permit as well, so it's combined. But the Department of Ecology issues it to county. It's a requirement that we have to be covered under the general municipal stormwater permit. And we just got a new permit. It was issued in 2012. It was effective August 2013, and that's where all this comes from, the requirements within that. We started sort of at a high level with our board in particular, and we created a vision and mission for this project to update our codes and manuals, but just kind of focusing on the mission, because I think it's important that people understand the framework in which we're operating under and how much flexibility we have. Our mission is to create stormwater management regulations that comply with state and federal regulations while being flexible and tailored to multiple project types, including making low-impact development the approach for stormwater management and site development. There's some important pieces of that. We'll get into that because we break this mission down into further goals, but our number one goal is to comply, but also do whatever we can do to make these new regulations, which are onerous, is easy and is efficient to implement in this county and with our stakeholders and applicants. So we're really trying to find ways that we can really make it flexible and tailored to the extent that we can, but there's not a lot of room for flexibility, and we'll get into that a little bit. Overall, I just want to run through some of the goals. Our number one goal is to adopt regulations that comply with state and federal water pollution control laws. That was important, particularly for us with our board as well, to get some head nodding that first and foremost our goal is compliance. We've just been through 5 years of a fairly tedious litigation process from the last time we did this. I just want to recognize that we are a bit under a spotlight. I'll mention that. And so we have to be really focused on what the permit says, and also recognizing that a lot of what we're going to be covering today was appealed in the permit, and that appeal, the results of that appeal, may influence what we're doing. But right now we're just heading forward with how it's written in the permit because the timelines are so short we can't wait for it. I think we've covered that before. So that's the second one. We need to meet permit deadlines for updating our development codes and our design manual. We have to have a draft design manual and draft development codes to Department of Ecology by the end of June. This year, in 2014, for Ecology's review and to get essentially from them their comments or approval for when we submit it finally, that they'd be willing to approve it, that they'll say that it complies with our permit. They get their comments back, and then we have until July 1, 2015 to adopt them and to adopt the code and manual and make it effective. So that's the timeline that we're under. We have about 6 months from now to get our draft done and get Ecology's input, and then about a year from midsummer before all this stuff goes live. Pretty short timelines for the amount of work that we had to do. In fact, we had to start working on it before the permit became effective just to meet it. Another one of our goals is to develop an integrated set of development codes that protect surface and groundwater from stormwater runoff. And by that, we're trying to let folks know that we're not going to just sort of myopically look at our stormwater regulations in a vacuum. We're not going to ignore all the rest of the development codes that people need to meet, because if we do that, we're going to create conflicts for people. So we're taking a more holistic look at how stormwater regulations factor into development projects and all of our other development codes to make sure that we get them working as seamlessly as possible. And that's easier said than done, but I think we're off to a really good start. Another goal was to tailor LID feasibility requirements to local conditions as much as we possibly can. So there are new requirements for development projects, a very small threshold. Even single family development needs to, at the conceptual stage, start looking at stormwater, at managing stormwater runoff using low impact development techniques. The permit requirements are fairly prescriptive, but we think there are some opportunities to tailor those given some soils, infiltration, other local issues, and we're exploring those opportunities with our technical advisory committee, with all the staff and different departments we're looking at. We've found a few opportunities for some tailoring of those feasibility requirements, but the initial look is it doesn't look like there's a ton of opportunity to tailor them. We will continue to look for those opportunities. We wanted to create a single stormwater manual for development projects. In our previous design manual, our approach was to create some local requirements in our design manual, but also link to the state's manual. And so people had to put multiple manuals on their desk and decide which to draw from. And we really decided to do a whole rewrite of our design manual and bring all the pieces of the state's manual that we want into it, but really to have sort of one-stop shopping. Still making links back to the state's manual where people can go for further information, but that's a tool that we think will be easier for people to use. And then under that, we also wanted to create a small projects manual that sort of distills the most important stuff for some of these smaller projects like single-family residential. It's easier for builders and applicants to use. That's something we're still striving for, but we won't start on until our main manual is done. We're taking a look at our application and review processes to try and streamline them, recognizing that this may shift some of the design to earlier on in the development process, so we want to make sure that people don't get hung up trying to get through our own review process. We've been working with Ali and our folks in building to try and find opportunities for that, engaging internal and external stakeholders, and then providing sufficient training and education for staff and the public, because there's a lot for us to learn. Most of the training and education, we're providing some opportunities now, kind of getting the word out. I think more in the latter part of 2014 and 15 is where we really ramp up those efforts once we have a good solid understanding of what we think our manual might look like. That's kind of where we're coming from, the sort of the legal framework that we're operating under. Does that make sense to folks? So this creates, these permit requirements create a project for us, and that project is made up of multiple parts. And these are the four main parts that we're looking at. The first one, we have a requirement to review the entirety of our development codes, pretty much all of Title 40, and identify potential barriers to making low impact development the primary method we use for managing runoff. We've done that. That the barrier analysis in our permit isn't due until probably 2016. Is that right, Jane?
March 2016.
But we decided to do it first. We wanted to do it up front because we wanted it to help us inform our design manual and our code rewrite. So the status of that is we've completed the initial review, and we'll go over some of those kind of high level results today. But that's a piece of the project. We also need to update codes based on the barrier review. And we'll get into that a little bit, but there were some recommendations where barriers were identified to meeting the LID requirements. And so that's not just the stormwater code, as it shows here, 4385, but that's other portions of the development code. And we're well on our way working on that process with an internal team, folks from planning as well as development engineering, that are helping us with that. The third part is our stormwater manual. So as I said, we're basically scrapping our old manual and we're rewriting our new one. It's a pretty significant process of where we're putting it together, and we'll go over the structure of that as well. We've changed it a few times as we started the process, but we've gotten really good feedback from our advisory groups that have sort of shaped where we're at today. We're at the point now where we pretty much have a solid draft for every single chapter in that manual, and we'll start to really refine that, and our intent is to get a public review draft out by the middle of March. I think that's what we decided on. So, because it's one thing for everybody to review it in bits and pieces, which we've been doing, but we want to make sure everyone can see the manual and how it all flows together. So we'll have that up for review relatively soon. And then the last part is reaching out to the public, both informing folks and getting info where we can with our stakeholder groups. But this is the project that we're implementing now. So to touch a little bit on what we found during our barrier review, we decided to approach the review in sort of a way unique to Clark County, but we categorized potential barriers into four main groups, and I wanted to run through those real quick with you guys. One, we were going to look for barriers that impose or encourage impervious surface. So one of the principles of low impact development, at least even from a site planning standpoint, is to minimize impervious surfaces. So we didn't want to be asking people to minimize impervious surfaces during stormwater site planning while at the same time have other portions of our code that might encourage impervious surface and send people in the wrong direction. So we're categorizing barriers into that category. We also were looking for potential barriers that created incompatible design standards, as it says here, such as prescribing landscaping materials that would preclude bioretention and or be unsuitable adjacent to pervious pavements. So we don't want to have We don't have, as it says here, require landscaping, say, for commercial projects that are incompatible with what we're asking folks to do to manage stormwater runoff. Procedural obstacles were another category we were looking for. This gets into some of the efficiency, because we don't want to tie people up in our development process because we've painted them into a corner. plan submit overview and approval procedures that complicate or are incompatible with the approaches for designing and building LID features. And then the last, we're looking for potential barriers or other requirements that encourage the removal or discourage the restoration of native vegetation, because preserving native vegetation on the site is another principle of LID and a requirement, one of the minimum requirements. So we wanted to see if we had anything in there that that was encouraging removal of native vegetation.
What do you mean by, what would encourage that?
Zone density?
Yeah.
Apartments, zoning apartments?
Yeah.
It encourages removal.
So there are a few things, and Jane or Rod can help me out because they are more familiar with the barrier analysis. But density was one that comes up. Requiring people to have certain portions of their site to be landscaped when completed might encourage someone to actually remove native vegetation to meet a landscaping requirement for certain visual goals, things like that. I don't know.
Can I just use your example up here?
Yeah.
In the diagram to the left, you circled three tree areas, it looks like.
Yeah.
It seems to imply that the code encouraged removal of that vegetation.
Yeah, in this particular case, it's more of an example of where native vegetation was removed for development. I'm not necessarily linking this to where, I don't know in these particular cases that we had code that encouraged the removal of that vegetation.
Well, it appears to be a standard plat right there.
Yeah.
And there's trees on it, like a lot of them have.
Yeah.
And you either leave the trees and it becomes a park, or you develop your plat and trees get removed.
Right.
This is something Eric and I have been
meaning. That sends a message right there that I'm not sure is the best message.
Okay. So far, when we do implement this code, people will be required to preserve native vegetation to the extent feasible.
To the extent feasible,
right? We love those terms.
Feasible. Yeah, I mean, what is that?
That's a good.
You probably wondered that too, right?
Yeah, we have. It was a pretty central part of many of the appeals. Is what does feasibility mean, or infeasibility, depending on the way you look at it. Some people might say that, well, if I leave this native vegetation, I can't do my project, so my project is infeasible because I can't build the number of lots or get the number of houses or do what I want to do. The state doesn't view it that way. So in part of what we're looking at here is that if this was a development project going in and if the goal was to retain what native vegetation that we could, what do we have in our development code that might be discouraging the retention of that native vegetation? Aside from what the applicant or landowner are trying to do, do we have anything in our code that's encouraging people to remove that?
Could there be kind of more of a form-based code that comes out of this as well, which gives flexibility to allow that preservation, but allows basically the zoning standards, I think, are a driver here.
That's a big one.
So, I mean, and the form-based code, would that be part of this, maybe, that would kind of allow more flexibility in those?
I mean, I don't know that we've identified form-based code as a potential solution. We can look at that.
Just as a consideration.
Yeah.
It may not be that, what that's called, but just something like that you end up with essentially the same thing, but you allow the applicant to essentially work around that in consideration of that.
Mm-hmm. With the application of density transfer to non-critical areas.
Right, to non-critical areas, density transfer, and zoning's a big issue because it's, our current comp plan and zoning wasn't necessarily set up under this framework, which we now have to bring in. So it creates conflicts.
Yeah. Native vegetation, those trees on that plat right there, those trees are probably what? 40 years old?
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, I know you're tasked with implementing or working this thing up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, native vegetation is, I think there is a definition in the permit of what native vegetation is, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's been there the whole time. I mean, I agree with you that, you know, if we have native species of plants there, it's native vegetation.
That were planted by the property owner.
Probably.
When
it was cleared originally, right, or something. Yeah, I mean, second growth, whatever.
What was the term you used, Ron? A reasonable something?
To the extent feasible.
Whose definition did you use?
The state's. They define feasible.
Okay. That doesn't always necessarily mean economic, right?
No, it absolutely doesn't mean economic. There are only economic provisions and things in very few of the requirements. One of them, for example, is green roofs.
That was one of the challenge items that EPA brought was in Pierce County, was that there wasn't any economic feasibility criteria. You asked them to say that.
Yeah, just a comment. When you're looking at doing that, you're combining, maintaining the native vegetation. You obviously also have a critical area and a wetland through the middle of the site, so you can't build there. When you do that, you're pushing that density out into other areas. So if we're trying to meet our comp plan goals, mm-hmm, and get a certain density, you're not going to be able to do both. So what you end up doing is it has adverse environmental impacts by creating more sprawl, because instead of doing that, you have to spread out, and your urban growth boundary has to increase quicker. That's more highways, more utilities, less density, where you have urban facilities. So perhaps that's a feasibility criteria that we can mention in the permit to justify. If you're in an urban growth boundary, there are enough environmental benefits to increasing the density in that area to offset the negative impacts. So it might be worth putting some of that discussion in the permit.
Yeah, a big part, and not only from what people have in terms of, you know, their buildable lands and their comp plans, but the common counter to that is, you know, you can do plan developments, you can do cluster, you can change zoning, but it runs afoul sometimes with the community's interest in having certain types of development, certain types of zoning. I mean, so if you say, if we hold everything else constant, we want to have the same amount of residential properties that are large lot size, then yeah, you're gonna have to bump out to get the same amount of density. So you need to get the same number of land area. So if we don't adjust anything else, then that's a conflict sometimes with community goals.
It's really a good segue to the comp plan update. I mean, what Eric's mentioning, which I think is really critical, is in the buildable lands analysis, how much more land would not be theoretically available. I mean, I know there'd be tools to basically allow consideration for density, but it seems like that'd be a key consideration.
It is. I mean, aligning it, that's one of the sort of necessary next steps, is saying, holding everything the same, what does this result in terms of not having the land that we want to have or we need to have, and then also what are the adjustments that need to be made, and that's a whole other discussion. Okay, so those are how we were looking at potential barriers. And again, this particular one was more just for seeing if we can eliminate any barriers that would encourage. I don't think we've found a lot of barriers, if any, that encourage the removal of native vegetation, but it was an important thing to check. So in all, through that process, I think we identified about 60 barriers of one of those four flavors. And very relatively few of those were identified as what we think are hard barriers that need to be addressed immediately. I think the recommendation of the 60, Jane or Rod, was how many?
Came down to about 17.
So we have about 17 barriers that we think we need to address as we look at our development codes, our stormwater code, and our design manual up front, leaving the other ones for sort of another place and time. And you know, they really weren't all that complicated. We didn't have any real hard barriers in our transportation standards, which is good. You know, we just updated a portion of our transportation standards a couple years ago, and Rod and I were able to participate in that process with Steve. And so I think we addressed a lot of those issues. So we can kind of table some of those for now. A lot of it was in parking standards, a lot of it was in landscaping and screening, those types of things that we think if we can provide some more flexibility, we can actually help people out, help utilize landscaped areas for stormwater management, where right now, as it's written, they can't do that. Those are the types of things that we're going to be addressing as we move forward. We have several reports written on the results of this analysis that I don't want to go through every individual change, and we can make that those accessible to you if you haven't seen them already. And one other thing we did, actually, I thought was pretty cool, was we took three, I believe, case studies, some recent development projects, and also ran them through what we thought would be going through the review process under the new standard given to us by the permit to see if these played out, and they essentially did. We didn't run into any new barriers in doing that. It was a good validation of what we essentially found in our review, and we have that report available as well. So this is, I'd say, our LID barrier review for our development code. It's about 90% done. We're going to kind of leave it where it is now as we do our code and manual and revisit it later down the line, because it's, you know, it's not due until 2016 sometime. But that's about where we are on that. And I'm glad we did it up front. Some of the other, as I said, we identified 17 of the 60 that we're going to address immediately, and then for the future, some other things to think about. Or what's listed up there now, adjusting setback requirements, for example, in commercial districts, adjusting widths of pavement requirements that can help us reduce impervious surfaces. As, like I said, it's not a hard barrier now, but we can provide some tools to help people reduce impervious area. Continuing to tweak the landscape requirements, parking and loading calculations. We found that in some of the requirements we encourage impervious area and requiring parking and loading areas. Transportation and circulation is something to revisit further down the line. And then, as Don has pointed out, the comp plan updates and sort of parallel processes is something we're working with community planning on. For our status, we're really focusing on our design manual right now. One of our goals was to simplify our code as much as possible. Really, in our code, we just basically want to say what your most basic requirements are for submitting applications for stormwater review, and then move everything else to the design manual. What I had suggested was that I wanted our code to be 2 pages, if possible. I don't think we're going to get 2 pages, but it's going to be close. So we're sort of we're moving the code along. We're working with Gordy Euler's helping us with that, and Jan Bazal is helping us with drafting our code, and we've been working with our prosecuting attorney's office. That's just sort of going on sort of a slow burn over on the side, and we're really mainly focusing on our design manual. We reorganized our design manual to be similar to what the state's manual is, but something that with input from our technical advisory committee, we want to organize in a way that seems to make a little more sense to us, and not to confuse with the state's manual. We didn't really want volumes and chapters, so we decided we'd call things books. So we've broken our manual out into 4 books, and I just want to run through that structure because I think that lets you know the direction we're heading. And as I said, we have a substantial amount of material so far under all of these chapters, but the first book is essentially the designer's manual. It has 5, I think it actually has 6 chapters in it, because there's a, is there 6 chapters in it?
Yeah, there is.
Okay. But so chapter 1 is determining applicable minimum requirements and submittal requirements, and we have that draft complete. Chapter 2 is basically treatment. Chapter 3 is flow control for projects. Chapter 4 is conveyance and offsite analysis. And then construction and erosion control comes in chapter 5.
Chapter 6 is admin.
Chapter 6 is administration and finance, I believe. So really, book 1 is kind of all about how to design a project and what you need to submit in order to get something to us to review. So that's where a lot of people will spend their time. in book two, we pulled out a lot of the best management practice design sheets and standard details. So rather than having that infused in all the chapters, like say when you're trying to do your runoff treatment design and having all the BMPs listed there, really started to grow the chapter and make it hard to find things that you needed. So we pulled all of the design sheets and details out of the design chapter and put it into a place that if somebody's looking for it, they can just go right to that book. They know what to get. Also, we're going, Jane's leading a process with our staff internally to redo our standard details. And I think the rough proportionality I heard in the meeting earlier today was we're going to keep about a third of the standard details. About a third of them we're going to rely on wash dot details rather than have redundant details. And another third we're basically going to be just be, they're essentially just sort of drawings that need further design, so we're just eliminating them and pulling design criteria out and putting them into the design sections. So our standard detail section, particularly for the stormwater details, should be a lot simpler to use, and it should be a significant improvement, easier to find too. Book three is on pollution source control. That drafts some project in process as well. That's essentially from a development standpoint or a design standpoint, what sort of post-construction pollution source control do you need to build into your site, things like spill containment, et cetera. But the majority of this chapter is used not really during the development process. It's for managing sites to minimize pollution in stormwater runoff, and that's something that we do separately through an inspection program. But that was a separate manual previously, and we're pulling it into this manual, but in a chapter that if you don't want to look at it, it's easy to avoid. And then the last book in our stormwater manual will be operations and maintenance. This is where we have to set our standards for maintenance so that we have something when we inspect a facility, whether it's public or private, to compare the maintenance condition to. At the same time, we're hearing a lot from our stakeholders, and particularly private folks like property management folks and homeowners associations, that they really want some procedures, some how-to procedures on how to go about, how often to inspect, how often to do certain maintenance activities. So we're taking a good hard look at that chapter now. Again, it'll be sort of a separate part of the manual. I think a significant improvement. And all this will be in one manual if you want, and it won't be in different places that you have to hunt it down. And then essentially where we are, as I said, we started early in the process. As we transition into 2014, the star indicates where we are. We're at the point in this area where, you know, we're reviewing progress with some of our, with our DEEB and our Clean Water Commission. We'll come back. We plan to come back later this spring after we have the complete review draft and it's out for public comment. And then the most significant pieces are near the end of the timeline where we submit. We have to submit the draft code to Ecology, as I mentioned out here, and then we have to have it adopted and effective by June
30, 2015. Question, please,
Ron. Yeah.
All the counties in the state are on this schedule?
No. We are, Clark County is one of the largest counties, so we have, I don't know if we've talked about this before, phase one and phase two.
Right.
So as a all the phase one counties and cities are on this schedule.
Is King County in phase one?
Yeah. Snohomish, King, Pierce, and Clark. Are the four counties, mm-hmm. and then Seattle and Tacoma are the phase one cities.
Do the counties, are the cities or municipalities within a county included in the county ordinance, or the city of Vancouver or city of Seattle have their own?
They'll have their own. So the phase two, all of, we have Camas, Washougal, Vancouver, and Battleground are all phase two permittees. They're on a lag timeline. So they have to do this as well, but they've got a year.
Okay.
So it in a way, the part that kind of bugs me about being on the same schedule as all the other phase one counties is we don't get to really coordinate with them very much and work with them because we're all racing towards the same endpoint. Mm-hmm. I would rather follow Pearson King and steal some of their stuff, mm-hmm. Which we can do as much as possible. But one thing we are definitely trying to do, and we have folks from Battleground and Vancouver on our advisory committees, is we're trying to create a design manual that we think is usable by cities here. And if they, if we create it in a way that they think they can use it, then they can just adopt it.
Yeah.
And then people don't have, and then it wouldn't be just wholesale different everywhere they go. And the last permit, you know, having separate development regulations for phase one and phase two communities creates a challenge because it's different in an unincorporated county as it is in the city. Everyone has the same requirements, but we're still messed up on the timeline. So they'll be coming in just a year after us. Hopefully we can use our stuff.
Thank you.
And that was it. That's, you know, other than some discussion, and I'd really like to hear from any of our other advisory group members that have been participating in the process. Like I said, well, once we get our design manual compiled, and that's where we really start a really hard review, because it will start taking shape, and people can start seeing what, you know, some of the potential impacts for the projects are going to be.
Ron, are some of the domino effect of this, or one of the elements of the domino effect of this, going to be somehow dovetailing the LID EMPs with other development regulations, the zoning code, for instance? I see increased setbacks, which automatically for anybody in the development industry is a bad thing, on the surface. So is that also going to be taking place concurrently with this, or we're going to suddenly see a bunch of biannual code changes with these large increases in setbacks in order to accommodate these LID facilities? Is that something that we can anticipate?
I would add, I'd say no, but I think any of the significant changes that we need to make to other parts of the development code in order to make this work are going to happen now.
Okay.
Yeah, some of the other, I think, more optional stuff that I brought the way the slides and talked about, longer term stuff, would be purely optional if we want to do it to make low impact development easier to do. And that may come over time, but I think if it's a significant change, you're going to see it now.
And do we have any of those changes now that you're considering?
Just some of the ones that I mentioned for like parking and landscaping, some of the
those appear to me to be more flexible.
They are.
Rather than restrictive.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think anything we come in down the line, particularly to accommodate LID and other parts of the development code, I don't think they're going to be more restrictive.
Okay.
I'd have to take a hard look at that setback bullet, and I don't know that it's necessarily a bad thing. It might have been setbacks of certain LID BMPs.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Sure.
The hardest ones, and you hit on them, Mike, are and, you know, the zoning and the comp plan stuff. That's something that we're not going to be able to tackle right away. We're going to have to align that with the update and exactly how far we go with that. I think there's another choice. It's a policy decision that we'll need to present to our board with, you know, involvement with community planning and others, and say, what do we want to do here? Do we want to try and make some accommodations so we don't have to, you know, bump the urban growth boundary out to make land? Those are the hardest ones, I think, down the road, those type of conflicts. But obviously that won't happen by the time we need to make this effective. We just don't want to make this effective on July 1, 2015, and start getting applications in and just have people just be stuck because we didn't think about some things.
Well, I would think that people are going to start designing to it before that.
Yeah.
That you'd want to have, I'm sure, it's some sort of, test project, or I don't know if the technical advisory committee is going to be doing something like that, but you know, we as engineers are going to have to act in advance, because we're going to have projects coming in after that.
Right.
Unless there's going to be some sort of grace period that we can submit under the old ordinance, and history would show that's not going to be the case.
Right. Vesting is an interesting issue, and it was ecology. They wrote about it in the permit and basically specified and said, if you don't have, if I can get this right, you guys know better than I do, but if you don't have your application in by the time it's effective, then you're not vested.
Right.
If you do have your application in by the time this is effective and you haven't gotten to construction, I think you have 5 years? So you have 5 years to construct, but if...
Seven now.
It ignores vesting.
In a way, it kind of upholds it in a way as well.
Yeah.
For the five year contingency.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they put the 5 year, and they even in their discussion they referenced the 5 years because of that's what the state had for class. Now that that's changed, it's a little fuzzy. But
I think it limits local government's ability to extend vesting, because you could extend vesting for projects, but you can't extend vesting for stormwater regulations, which, as we all have heard and know, that stormwater is such a driver of design, it essentially makes it challenging. So yeah, the permit does have requirements that we need to track to. If you don't have an application in by then you're under the make.
An application in for a preliminary or final?
Well, they don't specify. Okay.
I vote preliminary.
I don't know if
that's
it's not a final.
If you go by the planning vesting, you get vested at the pre-app if you submit with
your
system.
Yeah,
that's an application.
That'd be great.
Yeah. That's an application.
But I'm not sure how it works with the stormwater.
Well, they define application, I believe, Rob, don't they?
Yeah, it would be what you would normally call a fully completed application.
Yeah, they have some language in there that has enough information to review the project based on the regulations.
Yeah, I think it's
a little fuzzy because they don't go to each jurisdiction, but they do have a definition in there.
I think we'll need to write that into the code and definitely the resolution adopting ordinance what that means. But I think it's up to us to define application in our process, and it needs to be defensive.
On another topic, I've had some questions from contractors that there was this concern that the new permit is going to mandate require green roofs on all commercial buildings.
What did you say? Green roofs?
Green roofs.
Oh.
Is that the case or not?
No.
Good.
It's the only one that actually has a cost criteria attached
it
to
it. It does.
Green roofs is the only one.
Okay.
And what is the cost criteria measurement?
So that sets a precedent, which could be applied also.
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah. It's not a math point. It's not a percentage. Is it feasible?
Yeah, that's the only one that's a little, it has that cost.
I don't know if I started designing
irrigation
systems for commercial buildings or
buildings. No, they're not mandatory. I mean, it's part of a list, but it's easy to get around. That's my assessment. Okay.
Yeah, I was just going to ask. So is the end result kind of a mixture of qualitative and quantitative elements? I mean, is there a measurable thing that... When somebody finally gets to a permit process, once this is implemented, will there be kind of a mixture of, I mean, is it exactly a measurable thing, or is there some qualitative parts?
And so that's a lot of the detail we didn't really get into too much. But there is a quantitative performance standard for meeting the LID requirement. And you model it. If there are for certain types of projects opportunities to not use that performance standard, to not model it and use a checklist. And then in the checklist, it lays out, okay, these are the BMPs you need to consider and determine their feasibility on your site and do them in this order. And it's a challenge as well. So the performance standard is quantitative. The checklist is more qualitative.
Do you have a general schedule? This is a lot of work for you to do by June. It's like a ton of, that's like a huge project. Probably understatement. Yeah, I mean, so is there like a, do you have scheduled milestones for when people will check in and be able to see drafts of these?
You want to see it?
I'm sure you can email it.
It's constantly evolving, but Jane is our project manager on this, and Rod is responsible for making sure it happens, but Jane's put it all into project, and we have the big Gantt chart on the wall that gets replaced like every 3 days. We do have a pretty detailed task list, and we'll be happy to share that.
There's a lot to do. I mean, just reviewing at the time necessary, and the time frame between having the drafts and then the people on the committee finding time to review it and seeing how it all works together, because sometimes sections look good on their own, but the details that are coming out.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of issues where a little figure gets put in a detail, which was an example, and all of a sudden that becomes a maximum or a minimum.
Yeah.
And you know, that can be a problem. There's so many, that devil in the details.
It is a mess. The feedback,
so much to review.
The feedback that you guys, that we're getting from the TAC is really good, like that particular discussion. And we've already implemented a solution that I think is going to work. We're going to bring it back to TAC, but clearing up little things like that, and even adding in standard details that says, this is how standard details are supposed to be used and reviewed. This is how illustrations are supposed to be used and reviewed. You're really, really tackling some of those projects. But there isn't enough time. You know, as I said, these chapters are not small. They're 100 to 200 pages each. And when they get dropped on Rod's desk, and he has five of them, and we make Ali review them, and we make all kinds of people, and then we have to ask for folks to review. We're already way behind in our reviews, so we're struggling to meet our schedule now.
And started early.
Yeah, and we started early. We were one of the first to start. And then again, we'll see what happens with the appeal. If it changes anything, then we'll backtrack a little bit, but we have to comply. So.
Have you done any comparisons with your the other counties that are currently going through this process? Or is it just so daunting that you just kind of have to focus on what you can do right now?
Yeah, we're really focusing on what we're doing now. Both Pierce and King County had manuals that were more like the state's manual. In fact, the state's manual in large part, written to follow the King County manual. So they're not doing wholesale rewrites. They're spending some time looking at potential BMPs, and we could steal those at the end if we need to. It would be easy to have them. So we'll start collaborating more with them. I think after that first submittal, because Ecology will make everyone's draft submittal public, I believe, we'll be able to grab what other people have done and try and pull the good pieces in there. Okay. Well, thank you for your time. And
thank you.
I'm always available if you have questions, so let me know.
Good work.
Well, that was it for everything that we had on our agenda today. Did anybody else have anything else to add before we go to public comment? None seen. Anybody from the public have anything to say? Gary?
Mike, just to start for the board work sessions. The board has a work session on the I-502 on the 8th.
On January 8th?
Yep, January 8th.
That's a board hearing.
Work session.
Okay. I'm sorry, that's on what?
On 502.
On 502, okay. Okay, so that's in addition to the PC work session on 502. Which is on February 6th, so that will be in advance of that.
Right.
Okay. Good, thank you. Anything else? Seeing none, we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thanks, man. And congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
Hi.
Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah, I'll take care of it.
Yeah,
thanks for reminding. So you're not getting it right? You don't have one valid right now?
I've never had 2 hours.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No,
we need to get a collection of them.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
No.
I'll get it going.
Yeah. I don't mind. I was just thinking, because I was going to leave it.
Yeah. My daughter.